Hey friends, welcome to the Aging Well Together show on WCOM LP Chapel Hill Carrboro 103.5 FM, brought to you by the wonderful Orange County Department on Aging as well. So today is a special show, and it's a bittersweet show. One of the biggest fans of our show, and one of the biggest fans of me personally. My fabulous father passed away on January 1st, 2026. And so in his honor, I wanted to rebroadcast one of our earliest shows, Episode 3. My father, Dr. Stuart Altman, came on to the show to talk about his life and his world in the national health policy space. And so I'm heartbroken, but thought it might be lovely to rebroadcast that for all of you. And so here you go. And Dad, wherever you are, I love you. We have a very exciting local celebrity in my world and other worlds. We are welcomed today by Dr. Stuart Altman. I've got a bit of an introduction. Dr. Stuart Altman is the Saul C. Chaykin Professor of National Health Policy at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. More important to our local audience, he also is an adjunct professor in the Health Policy and Management Department at UNC Chapel Hill, the Gilling School of Global Public Health. Go Tar Heels. And Dr. Stuart Altman is an economist with 5 decades of experience working closely with issues of federal and state health policy within government, the private sector, and academia. In addition to teaching at Brandeis University, where he served as Dean of the Heller School for more than 25 years, and he also served as interim president of Brandeis University from 1990 to 1991. We may get into that a little bit. Dr. Altman has taught not just at Brandeis, but Brown University, UC Berkeley, and as I said, our own UNC here locally. Dr. Altman has been recognized as a leader in the healthcare field by Health Affairs and by Modern Healthcare, which in the past named him among the 30 most influential people in health policy over the past 30 years, and also is one of the top 100 most powerful people in healthcare. So in total, Dr. Altman acted as an advisor to 5 U.S. presidential administrations. Super excited to get into that. And he also served as chair of the Institute of Medicine Committee for the Evaluation on the Future of Nursing. More recently, Dr. Altman just finished up 10 years of serving as the chair of the Massachusetts Health Policy Commission as part of the state's attempt to moderate the growth in healthcare spending. While he's not doing all of that, he's also a published author with numerous books and journal articles. The most recent, Beyond Antitrust, Healthcare and Health Insurance Market Trends and the Future of Competition. And then my personal favorite, he wrote Power, Politics, and Universal Healthcare, the inside story of a century-long battle. So, wow, Dr. Altman, you've had such a long and full career. Now, full disclosure, some people are more comfortable calling you Professor Altman. Some people call you Dr. Altman. Some people call you Stuart or Stu. But I generally call you Dad. Hi, Dad. So, yes, if anyone didn't catch the connection with the last name, Stuart Altman is my father. And I used my personal connections to talk him into one of our inaugural shows to get him to share his wisdom. So it really wasn't too hard to convince him to come on Aging Well Together. Welcome, Daddy.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. What a pleasure. What a treat.
It's great to have you here. You have another title, which I have not told you, and I thought I'd tell you on air, so I'm not sure how you'll feel about it. But when I was telling the staff of the Department on Aging that I was able to talk you to come onto the show, they said, you know, your dad's also a super senior. They classified you as a super senior. So if you don't mind, I'm going to out you. Dad, how old are you?
Well, I had my 85th birthday last August, so I'm crawling up on 86.
Very impressive. And so I said, what's a super senior? And she said, fabulous seniors, 85 and older, doing great things. So, Dad, you have a new title, super senior.
Well, I'll take it. If I can, as long as I keep at it, I'm going to keep at it.
And I can help you with that.
All right.
See,
I love it.
Alicia's going to get us to her chair exercises, though. We're in, Dad's in great shape. He could do the standing exercises, too. We're all into it. All right. So, Dad, you spoke for a few moments. Oh, I like our awesome producer. I call him Grateful Dave. Said maybe you should just call him Dr. Dad. So,
Dr. Dad. Dr. I like that.
Dad. If anyone's listened to you for the past moment, they know you are not originally from Chapel Hill. So tell us a little bit about where are you from and where you grew up and how you got into this whole crazy world of health economics and policy.
Well, like many people, my life has been a series of interesting twists. I grew up in New York, as you can hear, and went to school, including the City College of New York, for an undergraduate. But then I wanted to see the rest of the country. And so at the age of just 22, with a new wife, the two of us went across the country to UCLA, where I received my PhD in economics. But the pull of the East Coast brought me back to Washington, D.C. in 1963. And after a stint at the Federal Reserve in Washington, I, of all places, wound up in the Defense Department, of all crazy places, because I was trained as a labor economist. And at that point, they were looking into what it would take to create an all-volunteer military and move away from the draft. So I spent a few years there. But then as this country got caught up in the Vietnam War, I said this was not for me and wound up moving to Rhode Island, mm-hmm. where I taught at Brown for a few years. But because of my interests, and if you'll excuse me for saying this, I wrote my dissertation on unemployed married women. Mm-hmm. And I had to explain to my professors, this is 1963 now,
okay,
that women were here to stay and that the labor force in the future was going to be dominated by women who have a career. And so that led me into, not surprisingly, being asked by the federal government to look into the supply of nurses. Like today, in the late 1960s, by this time, we had a serious shortage of nurses. Mm-hmm. And I did a study and a book on the future supply of nurses, which I have continued to be involved in studying and working with. Anyway, that got me into healthcare. Mm-hmm. And then in 1971, I became the Deputy Assistant Secretary of what was then the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And I was responsible for health policy for the department, and to some extent for, at that point, the Nixon administration. I know many of your listeners are probably hissing and booing now, and I could understand why, but the Nixon years were a very interesting years, and a lot of what we now take for granted as the high point in government activities took place in the early 1970s. So that was my life. After that, we can talk about it later, but that's what got me into the world of healthcare, and in particularly in the world of Medicare and Medicaid, which I'm sure your listeners are most interested in.
Mm-hmm. Well, you brought up Nixon, and I was going to ask you, when people meet you, the part of your bio that seems to fireworks go off is when they hear this sort of crazy statistic that you've worked under or in some capacity for five different presidential administrations. So I look at you both as an academic, and you've straddled the political sphere quite a bit. What was that like? So kind of walk us through five different, and you can name which presidents they were. I have a sense, but tell us about that. And Alicia's face is already like,
Yeah, I'd like to know which presidents.
You know, some I was more involved with than others, but the Nixon years were, I'll talk more about those later, I was pretty heavily involved. And if you Google my book, I'm not here selling it. You probably can get it as you probably can get a secondhand copy for $2 or something. So
it's worth it
every penny of
every
it.
Buck.
It turns out there was a Nixon was a very complicated person and a very complicated administration, and there were a lot of good things that were done during that period. There were also some things that weren't so good. So anyway, Nixon, I really got involved in a pretty fundamental way for President Clinton back in the early 1990s, and was a very much involved in the transition of his administration into office. And then I continued to be an outside advisor. And then I worked a little bit for candidate Barack Obama and then President Barack Obama, and a little bit for current President Biden. And I guess the last one, which is when I first started, was Lyndon Johnson. So I hit the five. Some, as I said, I was more involved than others.
I was going to say, do you have a favorite time period or a favorite presidential? I know there's a fun story about your time with President Clinton.
Well,
you were one of the first hired.
Right. I tell people, for those of your audience who remember, President Clinton put together what many considered to be the most complicated, confusing health reform plan the planet has ever seen. And I had the temerity at a very high-level meeting in Little Rock to tell him that I didn't think it was such a good idea. And I found myself a private citizen much faster than I expected. I usually don't tell that story sober, but since you asked, I guess I have to. But the good news was, even after I was sort of summarily put back into the private sector, I continued to be an advisor to him and to his wife, Hillary Clinton, who took over responsibility for health reform. Mm-hmm. So those Clinton years were very interesting.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so you have been through a ton of presidential administrations, and if my math serves me, I'll just say more than 50 years trying to bring about sane health policy and cost control issues around our country. And so, you know, just a tiny little question. Basically, over the 50 years, what's changed and what stayed the same? Yeah. What were the issues then and what are the issues now?
Well, what allows me to continue to function is a comment which is not necessarily a good comment, but some of the basic issues that we confronted back in 1971 are still the same issues that we confront today. Mm-hmm. And that is that we have too many Americans who lack any form of health insurance. And that is, in my mind, a crime that needs to be dealt with. Mm-hmm. And second, that we've created a healthcare delivery system, which in many respects is phenomenal in terms of helping people, curing people. But unfortunately, it is much too expensive and leaves people financially in dire straits. And so we need to figure out a way to continue, if not improve, the quality of care, access to care, but to do it at a rate that this country can afford.
Mm-hmm. I have a question, Dr. Dead. You mentioned the nursing health care, which is something you started with, and I'm finding that there are a lot of nurses that are frustrated and ready to finish the field or make the field, you know, leave the field altogether. Do you find that it's still strong, or do you think universal health care will kick in and kind of draw the nursing industry back up again?
Well, you're right. I think the current pandemic or that we lived through had an impact on nursing that we have never seen before. Mm-hmm. At one level, America was cheering their nurses mm-hmm. because of the tremendous activity and involvement, their willingness to come to work every day, to be involved with the sickest people. Unfortunately, many of them got sick themselves. We had stories about numbers of nurses actually dying. But they didn't, they lived through that. What really frustrated them was that segments of our society then turned against them. And actually, they went from being heroes to villains, which to my mind is just totally insane. Anyway, the net result is that they became burned out. And you're absolutely right. They are leaving the profession. But there's a good news side of the story. We are seeing more young people come into nursing, and we are gradually getting ourselves out of that terrible shortage environment that we had during the COVID pandemic. We're not out of it yet. Nursing is still a very honorable profession, where individuals who go into it are guaranteed a good job mm-hmm. at decent salaries. So the problem is real. You pointed it out. But we do see some sparkles of sunlight.
That's good. Thank you for answering that. What about universal health care as the United States of America?
Well, I am a big believer in universal health care to the extent that every American should have decent, high-quality, comprehensive health care. I do not think it needs to be totally funded by the government. There are many, people tend to think of universal health care as an all-government finance system. That's just one model. There are several highly well-functioning universal systems in this world, in Germany, in Switzerland, mm-hmm. in the Netherlands, where there is an overarching system run and controlled by the government, but where much of the financing of it comes from private individuals. And I think in the long run, each country develops their universal system from their own history. And for better or worse, the American history is for a public-private partnership. And that's what the plan developed by President Obama and promoted and expanded by President Biden, which originally was the Affordable Care Act, passed in 2010.
That's correct.
And under President Biden, we have the, you know, of all the funny names, but the Inflation Adjustment mm-hmm. Act and the American Rescue Plan. But both of them use government to expand and improve the system, but allow a continued involvement of private insurance and private employers. And I think that is going to be the model that this country will adopt.
Well, I'm glad. I'm sorry.
Can I ask him one more question about that? The insurance, the private industry, seeing that this was posed to me, so I'm trying to get it right. The lobbyists are lobbying for private industry because they are governing the insurance cost. Because of that, now it's kind of hard for the government to put a cap on it, or should the federal government be able to put a cap on what the private industry is doing to the average person who is unable to afford health insurance because the private industry is rich or making most of the money? And there's no governing of it except state by state. Should it be federal governed?
Well, we actually do have substantial federal regulations of private insurance. Most people don't realize this. In the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, there are very strong regulatory restrictions on how much money a private insurance company can make. By law, no commercial insurance company can charge a premium which is more than 15% above the amount of money that the insurance company spends on health care. And that 15% has to cover all their expenses, including their profits, wages they pay their workers, their rent, and so on. And so private insurance, and then there's a whole bunch of other regulations. It used to be that private insurance could not cover a person if they had a pre-existing condition or if they had the potential of having a pre-existing condition. That is now against the law. So, they have their lobbyists, but I think I know for a fact that we overstate the power of the insurance industry by itself. But, you know, you're absolutely right. Left alone, the private insurance companies would not do everything that we think they should do. So I'm a big believer in strong government oversight. That's what exists in these other countries. In Germany, most people don't know this, that almost all of the money that funds the German health system comes from a combination of employers and employees. Hmm. However, the government dictates what percentage of an individual's income that the insurance companies can charge. It also regulates the insurance industry on how much they pay to the hospitals and the doctors. That's what we need to do. We need to have a strong government. The reason why I think that we need that combination are two. One, as I said before, every country that developed universal coverage developed it in a different way based on their history. Canada is very different than England. England is very different than France. France is very different than Scandinavia. And then we have Germany and so on. So we have to recognize, for better or worse, we are in a country that has had a very strong, powerful private sector. Mm-hmm. And to sort of wake up in the morning and say, it's all gone, isn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. So the pragmatist in me, I'm sorry, I've been at this a long time and mm-hmm. I've been trying the best I can, and I think we've made a lot of success. We're a lot better off today. We have the lowest uninsured rate in the history of America. And it's been done by government overarching and pushing the system. So that's the first reason. That's our history. The second reason, I don't think it's in the best interest of our most marginal populations that really need the government's help to have everyone covered, because once everyone would be covered and it would have to go through the tax system, we have all kind of examples of how that system would get squeezed. And unfortunately, the people who would pay the highest price would be the people with the least amount of power. Mm-hmm. So I think it's in the best interest of the people that really need government to help them that all of us don't need to be in that pie. Mm-hmm. Now, I realize that people would disagree with me, and I disagree with myself 82% of the time. This is not, I don't come at this, you know, casually. I can make a very strong argument for all government, mm-hmm. but at the end of the day, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe 60 years, not 50, 60 years, you know, it's made me just shell-shocked, but I feel very confident that if we're going to get universal coverage, which is what I believe in, it needs to be with a public-private partnership.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
I was going to ask, because you mentioned the other countries, and there are, and we'll come back to the U.S. in a second, but there are a lot of people that say, why can't we be like Canada? Why can't we be like Britain? Mm-hmm. And so I was going to say, you know, what is it about America that makes us so unique? Though you did mention some other countries that do have a public-private. Are we just... Is there also a bit of distrust of the government that we want to have this sort of hybrid model, even though some people
well,
say...
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, hey, we're in the state of North Carolina. You tell me, you know, I mean, I'm having troubles of, you know, I'm not a big fan of a lot of the things that are happening in the great state of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you know, again, yes, our history has been to not rely on government for everything that's important. So I am pushing to have government play a much bigger role, but I'm trying to say that there are things that only government can do, mm-hmm. and there are things that government could do but could be done by others. And so that's why I want it. And I also want to make sure that our health system, even with all of its problems, continues to stay vibrant and produce high-quality care. And it is capable of providing high-quality care. The problem is it doesn't provide it to every segment of our society. Mm-hmm. So that's where I come from. I would not, you know, if I saw that we had an opportunity to do it a different way, I wouldn't be against it. Mm-hmm. But I think we have a much better likelihood of success in terms of getting universal coverage with a public-private partnership.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things, as I have followed you around for the past 52 years of my own life, is your amazing ability to connect with people of all ages. I've watched you as a professor. I watch you host all kinds of meetings. You do all speeches for folks in different kinds of conferences. As I was thinking about it, you talk with folks, your audience ranges from 19 to 90, even in the past few months. I watched the group because you teach undergraduate students. I know you have meetings with policymakers. And then you also are talking with lots of older adults. I've come along with you as you meet with local senior groups in the community. What are the messages that seem to stay consistent, or the issues that seem most relevant, regardless of whether you're talking to 19 to 90-year-olds? What is it that, in its simplest, most basic form, because I think one of your skill sets is being able to drill down really complex political and healthcare issues down to all of us in the lay space?
Well, yes, I do talk to different groups. And it's not as straightforward as you say or you know. I mean, trying to convince an 18-year-old that they should be concerned about Medicare takes a little doing, I must admit. I have to dance around a little bit and try to make it relevant to them. It's much easier dealing with the 80-year-olds who live every day with the good and the bad of their Medicare program and their inability or ability to impact on the health system. But at the end of the day, it is true that there are some basics that every group wants to know. Mm-hmm. They want to know, A, how it affects them, how it affects their family, how it affects, you know, the community that mm-hmm. they live in. And the 18-year-old, while they don't admit it all the time, do think about their parents occasionally. And even more so, they think about their grandparents, which I love, since I have 5 wonderful granddaughters. And so I explain health care in relationship to their grandparents and to their parents. And then I caution them to not be so cavalier, because they may get lucky and live a good life, which means they're going to face the same problems that their parents and grandparents are facing. Mm-hmm. So, for the most part, it's worked.
Well, and I'll tell our listeners, because I have seen you on your Zoom classes now that so many classes have gone online. Just this past fall, you had like 150, listeners, he really is talking to a bunch of 18 and 19-year-olds. You teach an undergraduate national health policy class, and there was 150 boxes or so just looking at you saying, you know, Professor Altman, teach us about our health care system and teach us about national health policy. And that's a very unique audience.
Wow, that's a wow coming from that generation.
Well, yeah, I will admit, I do it on Zoom because I'm still teaching at Brandeis, which is in Waltham, Massachusetts. But now, as you know well, my home is here in Chapel Hill. So I am teaching via Zoom. I will admit, though, that I really miss being able to see them and walk up and down the aisles and dance around and do what I do. But
and your class, I will say, for, I don't know, 10, 20 years or so, has been rated one of the top 5 classes that you must take at Brandeis is Professor Stuart Altman's class on what national health policy. And so I talked to some Brandeis students now, and they're like, oh, he is famous. So you do have your pulse on our younger generation, but yet it's the older generation. I saw you do a talk to one of our local senior groups, and they had all kinds of questions, and those get real specific. Tell us about what's happening with our Medicare. Tell us about what we need to be involved with. So it's, I guess, more relevant for certain groups.
Well, it is true. When I talk to our senior citizen groups, their questions are very specific about issues that affect them. Although they also are thinking about the broad, like the question you raised about universal coverage and national health insurance and what's going on with our Medicare program. And so, you know, it does require a somewhat different cadence to what I have to say. But one of the things that I've learned is that much of what I talk about is relevant regardless mm-hmm. of their age. Mm-hmm.
I have another question from
sure.
the public. I like that. I mean, I'm for the people.
Alicia's the voice of the public. I guess I'm the voice of your family, your nagging child.
No, the wonderful daughter. A lot of doctors now are coming to the home again. That was a question that I was, and that's something new. It happened before. Now we're back at that again. How are we doing with that? How are we going to accept that? The younger generation, it's cool for them because the doctor comes to the house. But for me, I want to go, if I had to go, I think I'd like to go to the office.
So how is that balancing out with the doctor?
You're right on. So when I grew up, we did have the doctor with his little, and it was mostly a him, with his black bag coming into our home and providing the care. The good and the bad news of that was it was good to have them in your house, but their capacity to deal with a problem was only what they could carry in that black bag. It's also a very inefficient way of using the skills of physicians because, you know, they can see maybe 10 patients a day if they have to go from community to community, where they can see, you know, 30, 40, 50 patients if they have them lined up in their office. But you know, you are correct. There is a new movement. Some people call it hospital at home or healthcare at home, where we are seeing a return somewhat of care being provided at the in the home. My own view is that that will be limited, that there are times, for example, Heather knows much more about this than I do, particularly in our long-term care areas where people really would prefer to be home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now they need a stable home. They need individuals in that home who can care for them. So it's not for everybody. Mm-hmm. But if that person can stay in their home, bringing the healthcare system to them is preferred. We also have technology now where you could actually, I've just was talking to someone where there are now companies with vans, where the vans have MRI machines, they have they actually can do surgery at home if needed. So I said before with the public-private partnership, I think we're going to evolve a bifurcated or even trifurcated system where for certain people and for certain kind of care, it can be provided at home. But I think the majority of health care will continue to be in the clinic, in the physician's office, in the hospital, in the long-term care facility. Mm-hmm. But I'm watching and seeing how this healthcare at home evolves, and it probably will grow a little bit in the years to come.
Mm-hmm. And there has been quite a growth, and I've been a fan of it. There's mixed feelings about telehealth, but I was a big fan of it, especially during the pandemic, in the crazy days when it was so complicated to get to doctor's offices or hospitals. They were closed or families were being separated. My dad and I were both a caregiver to my mom, who ended up having an end-of-life experience at home. We didn't realize it at the time, and it would be really, really complicated to have her go to doctor's offices during that craziness. And so for us, telehealth was a lifeline. I know lots of folks have mixed feelings about it. It does. You have to have good broadband internet. It can be helpful in rural areas, or it can be complicated in rural areas if you don't have internet connection. But the ability to connect with specialists and not have to leave our home was a lifesaver. But again, certain circumstances, things are really helpful and supportive. And then I think at others, so I'm a big fan of the hospital at home model, if it makes sense, if it's the kind of services that folks can receive at the home, if they do have support at home. And I think that is completely under-recognized and undervalued, are our 53 million caregivers. And when I talk with the folks in my space, a lot of this hospital at home you need someone else there in many cases 24/7, and that's usually a family member or a friend or undervalued caregivers. And so where's the support in terms of even policy, the both tangible support, financial support for our caregivers, many of whom have to leave work in order to provide that? So this partnership between the healthcare system and family caregivers, I think, still needs to be fleshed out quite a bit.
Absolutely.
Is that being looked into, the caregiver? Because the caregiver is, to me, right up there with the nurse in some instances. How do we, but we're not valuing the caregiver as far as giving them what they need to care, like continual pay or just time.
I think you guys are both talking about very legitimate and very serious. What we're talking about is the unpaid family or friend caregiver as opposed to the professional. And our system has always depended on large numbers of family caregivers to provide care. And now more than ever, with shortages of what we call professionals, the family caregiver is even more important. And you're absolutely correct. There are a whole bunch of public activities that can support that, whether it's having a substitute so that they can get out and have some help so they don't have to do it 24/7 every day, every so on. Some professional help to come in. And as you pointed out, trying to find some way of giving them some financial help is very important. And there are a number of programs around the country that are trying to do that. I think we're better served in what we would call there's a technical term called capitation, rather than fee-for-service, where an organization gets the fixed amount of money and then they can allocate that money and they can see the benefit of having a family caregiver and actually provide them. What won't work well is the fee-for-service, because then you have all this billing and second-guessing whether the care is... So I do see a movement towards what we call capitation payments and the ability of these organizations that are closer to the individual to provide the help so that they can use these family caregivers.
I picked up my phone so I could get the official title. President Biden recently stepped into this in a beautiful way. He issued his executive order on family caregiving just last month. And so there is the RAISE national strategy for family caregivers that really outlines what states can do and what families can do. It's sort of embarrassing. I've gone to so many conferences or discussions on it recently. I should know more. But there are suggestions and recommendations. It's just we're first at the awareness and acknowledgement stage, and now we're turning it into action. And so we are seeing both nationally the executive order on family caregiving. Just a week and a half ago, our own Governor Cooper did his executive order making North Carolina an age-friendly state. And so part of that is looking at caregivers. Right now, that's looking mostly at our, and it's hard to call it professional caregivers, our paid caregivers, because so many, or formal caregivers, so many family caregivers struggle with the term because they're like, we're formal or we're professional in our way. But so there are efforts happening both at the state level and at the national level that I think will be exciting. But for many of us, especially during healthcare crises, it doesn't come quick enough. But it's nice that it's part of the conversation. So, speaking of caregiving, Dad, you were coughing just a second ago, and so I'm going to throw you into it. I don't know if our listeners heard, but you are almost on the four-year anniversary. You had your own little brush with a healthcare experience. You got incredibly sick, and we almost lost you, but now you are back with a vengeance, and you are the super senior in terms of your resilience. But I feel like you took your job a bit seriously, where you wanted to really understand the healthcare system from the inside out.
Oh. Yeah, that's right. Some people say I was like the secret shopper.
Oh.
I deliberately got myself so sick so I could see what it's like to spend 6 weeks in the ICU.
So your cough is a little bit of
it's a reminder.
It's your souvenir of your ventilator time. But
so did you find that you got a little more hands-on understanding on the total environment that you experienced?
I got more understanding than I wanted. I came away. It's a long story, which I won't go into, but.
Was it eye-openers?
In general. The care that I got when I was sick was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I appreciated the quality of the nursing and their willingness to put up with events that are not always enjoyable. I did not come away as a real critic. I also, as Heather knows well, there's a real question of how I got sick in the first place and how much of it was the fault of the healthcare system. But we don't know really what mm-hmm. happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I for the most part, found across the board, whether it was in the ICU or in the hospital or in the rehab facility or my family, which were phenomenal. I can't say enough for my family and what they went through and what they did. But on all of those fronts, I came away very positive about the healthcare system and what they did to get me back in shape so that I can continue to function.
Mm-hmm. The doctors asked us early on, you know, what quality of life are we getting back to? And I remember there was a physical therapist that said, what's his baseline? Is he needing like a wheelchair or a walker? And I said, his baseline is on stage giving a speech. You are getting him back on stage. And they did. I was excited.
They got me back.
But have you found that the experience, do you just shove it all back into the back of your mind? Or do you find that it has affected you professionally as you move forward?
For the most part, I shove it back. It has affected me personally. My tennis days are over, although I am trying to play pickleball.
I think that if you came to my class, I could help you get there.
Alicia, we knew she was going right. to keep pushing yeah, this class. Now we are
a,
so
that
in.
Was a toss to you, Alicia.
I will work on that.
But I try to take a walk every day. Sometimes I even get my daughter Heather to join me, as she did yesterday. Mm-hmm. I do occasionally play pickleball. I'm going to try to get back on the golf course. And who knows, I might actually hit the tennis ball.
I think you can do it. If it's in your mind, you can do it, you can do
so
it.
So I don't dwell on it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are certain limitations physically I now have as a result of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I live with it, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to live every day and enjoy it.
Though it's funny, you do have a little bit of a cough, and that's been interesting. This happened before the pandemic, but right as the pandemic was starting, and this cough that you have, do you remember right in the beginning of the pandemic, I created a sticker saying, excuse my cough, it's not contagious.
Oh.
You know, because everyone looks at you like, what are you?
Yes, I do. When I sit down in an airplane, I do have to tell the person sitting next to me, I will cough during this flight, but I am not sick. And most of them say, well, I appreciate you telling me that.
Yeah.
So yes, this cough is a reminder that having had a tube down my throat for 3 months has some long term effects.
Can I ask you one more question? Because do you find that people are living longer? Because I have people in class that are 100. They say they are. I don't believe them. But so we're in a generation now that you're young. You're younger than my husband. I hope he's not listening. But are you finding that with where we are in our healthcare and in the way we take care of our bodies and in the way we're thinking, that longevity has occurred to go past the numbers that once were in the 80s to past the 100s, maybe?
No question. Well, you're in a better position than I am to answer that. As you said, you have people in your class that claim they're 100. I mean, that, you know, my father died at 66. Mm. My wife's father died at 67. Mm. Both of them from events that today would not have led to death. Mm. So on the one hand, medical care has substantially improved, mm-hmm. particularly for heart conditions. We also are finally getting breakthroughs on the cancer side. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there are still a lot of problems that our healthcare system can't deal with. So part of it is the medical system. Mm-hmm. But as you pointed out, we also have learned physical exercise makes a big difference. What we eat makes a big difference. So that combination of lifestyle mm-hmm. and medical care is leading to more and more of us, you know, reaching 90. I don't even want to say 80 because I flew right by it. I'm looking forward to reaching 90. I don't know about 100, but I think that's something, well, let me, I was going to say that's something we could be proud of. However, recent statistics are not very encouraging. For the first time in my lifetime, if not history of this country, length of life has fallen.
Wow.
In the last couple of years, we have seen in this country a decline in age of life. And other now part of it was as a result of COVID.
Right.
Part of it is a result of the opioid epidemic and the fentanyl and all that negative. Part of it is our gun culture. Mm-hmm. But part of it goes back to the first thing we talked about. Too many Americans
obesity
are not getting or denied the quality of care that we are capable of providing. So yes, there is some very good news out there, but there is some news that's not so good.
Well, so we're going to wrap up in just a few minutes, and so Dad, with your few minutes and with your number of years you have left, you've had 50 years to fix our entire healthcare system. What left is there to do now? So there's still a lot of work to be done. What are your goals?
I have deliberately left a few things for your generation to do. I could have solved all the problems, but I left a few. I wish, I'm not kidding, not intentionally. Unfortunately, the journey, I don't even know if it's half over. As I said, on the one hand, we have fewer Americans who lack health insurance than we've had in our history. Mm-hmm. But the numbers are still over 20 million. Mm-hmm. 20 million Americans on any given day lack health insurance. That is not good. It used to be 40 to 50 million. So there's a good news, bad news. Healthcare costs. When I started in 1971, it's hard to believe we were spending $75 billion. Sorry. it amounted to 7.5% of our GDP. We're now at $4.5 trillion. Mm. It's almost 20%.
Wow.
Which means one out of every $5 spent in this country goes for health care. Mm. That is an amount that cannot continue to grow at the level it's going. So we got work to do, and I'm turning this over to your generation, Heather. And you better do a damn well better
there
job than I did.
All right. Well, with that, yeah, we have our work to do, and it's time to close out this show. But Alicia, thank you for joining me as my co-host and dad. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on Aging Well Together. If you have any comments to share, be kind. But if you have comments to share about upcoming show topics, we'd love to hear from you. We are at agingwelltogethershow@gmail.com and want to give a shout out to my colleagues here at WCOMLP Chapel Hill Carrboro, where we're coming to you on 103.5. And a special thank you hug in the other room to Grateful Dave. Grateful Dave, who has his own show here, has been our producer. He's helping me out learn the ropes here. So thank you, Dave. Alicia, thank you. And Dad, many thanks. Take care, everyone.